From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Jimmy Hoffa has made no secret that one of his number one goals is to end the court-ordered federal supervision of the union. I think his shift to the supporting Republicans is clearly an attempt to implement that strategy.
The Teamsters, one of the largest unions in the U.S., are meeting in Las Vegas to select presidential candidates as charges of corruption dog. James Hoffa will speak with one of his challengers. And in 1993, the Clinton administration said free trade would be the savior of American culture. Today, a landmark report finds falling wages, rising prices, and huge profits for agribusiness. We'll have a debate. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Senate Democrats won two significant victories yesterday as the Senate rejected Republican challenges to provisions of a Democratic bill to define patients' rights for more than 180 million Americans. The back-to-back votes, combined with a similar vote last week, create a sense that the bill is gaining momentum after being tied up in a partisan impasse for nearly 5 years. By a vote of 57 to 43, the Senate rejected a Republican proposal to provide employers with complete immunity against lawsuits by employees who challenge the denial of their claims for health benefits. Republicans said the risk of such lawsuits would prompt employers to stop offering coverage, but Democrats said employers should be liable when they directly participate in decisions that harm patients. The vote put pressure on President Bush to drop his veto threat. South African President Thabo Mbeki skipped the United Nations Conference on AIDS at the United Nations to come to the White House yesterday, where President Bush helped him deflect accusations his government has all but neglected the AIDS epidemic. Delegates at the UN AIDS conference headed into the final day of the historic global gathering with an agreement on a plan to fight HIV and AIDS for years to come. Weeks of wrangling ended late last night when Western nations agreed to drop language specifically naming groups vulnerable to the disease, including gays and prostitutes, because it was offensive to some Muslim nations. As diplomats wrapped up negotiations in New York, the House International Relations Committee in Washington agreed to add more than $1.3 billion in the global campaign to fight AIDS. Vice President Dick Cheney has declined to identify the people who met privately with his energy task force, raising tensions with congressional investigators who've repeatedly requested the information. Some Democrats have asserted that leading Republican donors had special access to the task force and that the energy policy is skewed toward measures favored by major corporations. The White House provided the General Accounting Office with financial records of the task force, but administration officials have told the investigative body they're not compelled to provide the names of outsiders who met with the task force. The letter from the GAO warned that if the White House doesn't provide the full range of information it's seeking, it may issue a demand letter, a more formal request. Under the law, the White House would have 20 days to respond. If the dispute continues, the accounting office could bring a civil action against the Bush administration. The Hawaii Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights says urgent action is needed to establish federal recognition of Native Hawaiians similar to that given American Indian tribes. Without recognition or at least a process toward gaining recognition, the committee, made up of Hawaii residents, says it's clear that the civil and political rights of Native Hawaiians will continue to erode. Among the panel's recommendations were expanding social and economic programs for Native Hawaiians, including more funding for education, job training, medical services, housing, cultural centers, and language immersion programs. The report comes in the wake of a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court last year that the Hawaiians' only voting requirement for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs was unconstitutional racial discrimination. The World Court ruled against the United States yesterday for ignoring the international legal rights of two German-born brothers who were executed for murder. Germany filed a case with the International Court of Justice in 1999, arguing U.S. officials violated the Vienna Convention by not informing its consular officials of the arrest and conviction of Walter and Carl Legrand. They had been found guilty of killing a bank manager in a 1982 robbery. And Europe's top human rights institution is threatening to impose sanctions on the U.S. and Japan. The Council of Europe passed a resolution yesterday saying the two countries should lose their observer status unless they stop all executions without delay and move to repeal the death penalty by the year 2003. Yugoslavia intensified efforts to extradite Slobodan Milosevic today, with a Belgrade judge heading to prison to read him the extradition order that would send him to the UN War Crimes Tribunal for trial. If extradited, Milosevic would be the first former head of state to face a war crimes trial in front of the tribunal established in 1992 in The Hague, Netherlands. The moves to extradite Milosevic intensified as Yugoslavia's pro-democracy government sought to meet international demands ahead of a key donors conference Friday in Brussels, Belgium. Washington has linked U.S. aid to Milosevic's extradition. Macedonia's president said the Balkan country could have been brought to civil war through rioting triggered by the U.S.-assisted NATO evacuation of ethnic Albanian rebels. Comment came a day after a convoy of about 20 U.S. contracted buses, protected by 81 U.S. troops and armed Humvees, transported ethnic Albanian fighters and civilians from a suburb of Macedonia's capital to a mostly ethnic Albanian village to the north. The move sparked rioting and shooting in the capital by thousands of Macedonian Slavs who demanded harsher action against the rebels and an end to outside intervention. In Washington, Bush administration officials claim the decision to use U.S. troops to protect the convoy did not indicate a widening U.S. involvement. This news from Puerto Rico: a judge sentenced the Reverend Jesse Jackson's wife to two more days in a detention center yesterday, ignoring her pleas to be released after serving more than a week behind bars for trespassing on Vieques. In Vieques, meanwhile, the Navy continues the bombing of the island, even as more protesters gather to get arrested. 53 people have been detained in the past week. Authorities arrested nationalist Lolita Lebron, who was jailed for 25 years for the 1954 shooting attack on the U.S. House of Representatives that wounded five lawmakers. "Long live a free Puerto Rico," Lebron yelled, 81 years old, as her group of six cut through a fence that leads to the bombing range. Mayor Rafael Cordero Santiago of Ponce, Puerto Rico's second city, broke into the Navy land on Monday and was arrested Tuesday when he came out of hiding. In a surprising setback for President Bush and his plans to further open trade, the House voted yesterday to block the Transportation Department from issuing permits that would let Mexican trucks operate throughout the United States. Are listening to Democracy Now! That's A3, Woke Up This Morning, here on Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 4,000 delegates from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters are meeting this week in Las Vegas to nominate candidates for the presidency of one of the nation's largest unions. In the 2 years since James Hoffa Jr., son of the infamous Jimmy Hoffa, became president of the union, the Teamsters have struggled to define themselves both internally and in their relationship to the progressive movement as a whole. Progressives cheered when the Teamsters marched with environmental activists at the November 1999 demonstrations against the WTO in Seattle, and when Teamsters President Hoffa met with Ralph Nader during last year's presidential campaign. But Hafa, who has sharply criticized the free trade area of the Americas, has also made overtures to the Bush administration. In May, he came out in support of the administration's energy plan and in favor of oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, decisions which have been criticized by other progressive unions and environmental groups. Teamsters President James Hafa has made no secret of his desire to convince the Bush administration to end federal control of the union, which was established 12 years ago to settle a civil racketeering lawsuit brought against the union for its extensive mob ties. He claims the union is free of corruption and moving toward democratic control. His critics, among them the insurgent group Teamsters for a Democratic Union, charge that corruption continues, that the union has failed to devote the resources needed to expand the union's organizing efforts and increase membership. The critics' case has been bolstered by new accusations this week that a top aide to Hafa masterminded a sweetheart deal to undercut Teamsters members in Las Vegas by giving jobs to non-union workers. Hafa is being challenged for the presidency of the Teamsters by Tom Leadham, an Oregon Teamster official who ran against him in 1998 after former Teamsters President Ron Kerry was forced to withdraw following allegations of corruption. The election for Teamsters president will be conducted by mail in the fall. The election may define the relationship of the union to progressives on many issues, especially the environment, where President Bush seems intent on dividing labor from other movements for social justice. We're joined today by Carl Beers with the Association for Union Democracy in New York, which advises unions around the country, and Tom Leadham, member of the Teamsters from Oregon, who is running against James Hafa for president of the union, joining us from the Las Vegas convention. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And it's good to have you with us, Tom Leadham.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Tom Leadham, yesterday when James Hafa spoke, he hailed the decision to do direct elections of the top Teamster leaders, saying that this was guaranteeing that the Teamsters were the most democratic union around. Can you talk about these direct elections and what they mean?
Well, of course, we're pleased that Mr. Hafa and several of his allies have finally agreed with us on the necessity for a direct election of top officers of our union. They're making the claim that it's the most democratic union. I believe it is a much more democratic union, certainly, than it was before 1991. However, the devil's in the details with this new package, because it gives the package that was presented by Mr. Hafa to the convention delegates actually gives the incumbents the ability to set the rules for the election. And in a union the size of the Teamsters, which is 1.4 million voting members in the U.S. and Canada, the rules are extremely important in how you have access to Teamster members. There are a lot of advantages that go along with incumbency. We've pushed for more of a level playing field. I'm not sure how we will get that with incumbents setting the rules.
Can you explain the report that came out this week, the accusations that could lead to the expulsion of the top aides to James Hafa?
Well, it's just more in a long list of problems that the Hafa administration has had. But these are very serious. They involve a Las Vegas local. They involve allies and aides of Mr. Hafa actually conspiring with a non-union employee broker to take jobs from Teamsters in the Las Vegas convention industry. The IRB issued a stinging report, 200-page document. It involved Mr. Hafa in meetings, although he was not charged. But it really begs the question of, since he had meetings involving the people that were involved over this subject, He had a responsibility to know what was going on, even if he didn't. And you know, we expect more to come from this certainly, but there have been a number of these kinds of problems in the union.
I want to bring Carl Beers into the discussion with the Association for Union Democracy in New York. And I should say we called repeatedly over the last 2 days into what's known as the bunker at Bally's in Las Vegas to try to get either James Hoffa or one of his spokespeople to be on as well, to no avail. But yesterday, the Times, Stephen Greenhouse, had an interesting piece to set the backdrop of what's going on in Las Vegas right now. He said, "The last time the Teamsters held a big convention here 15 years ago, their president at the time, Jackie Presser, was borne into a banquet room reclining on an imperial chariot wheeled by men wearing the costumes of Roman soldiers. The 300-pound Mr. Presser, who'd been charged with embezzlement the week before, beamed as hundreds of Teamsters feasted and the loudspeaker proclaimed, 'Hail Caesar!' Vegas and the Teamsters go way back. The Mafia helped build some of the city's original casinos in the 50s with the help of hundreds of millions of dollars in sweetheart loans from the Teamsters' Central States Pension Fund. One former Teamster president was convicted of conspiring to bribe a U.S. senator from Nevada. So as more than 4,000 Teamsters pack the convention hall at the lavish Paris Casino today to begin their 26th International Convention, there was a lot of uneasy snickering." But Las Vegas is also a real Gettysburg of the labor movement today. It is one of the fastest growing cities and union, one of the sites of major union organizing in the country. Can you talk about the Teamsters' history and where you feel James Hoffa is taking it today?
Well, the kind of corruption that Steve Greenhouse described in his article there and you just read is exactly why you have a government imposed consent decree on the union. And the great danger here is that that will come back, that Hoffa and many of his supporters are the heirs to that sort of corruption. And the fact that Jimmy Hoffa has made ending government oversight, and you mentioned in your introduction, Amy, that you use the word control. It really isn't control over the union. It's simply a government investigative body that can investigate and charge officials with crimes and wrongdoing and expel them from the union and federally supervised union elections. There's no control over bargaining. There's no control over staff. They don't set salaries or anything like that. So the union is largely autonomous, but it must operate under this oversight, which is intended to root out that kind of corruption.
And that began, what, in 1989?
That began in 1989. And since then, there has been a steady stream of dozens, if not hundreds, of officials who've been removed by this government oversight. And the fact that Hoffa makes this one of his top priorities, if not his very top priority, is in itself very suspect. Now, I'm a little more cynical about the direct elections than maybe Mr. Liedem is. Hoffa has engaged in, I think, a very, very impressive public relations campaign to convince the public and the government that he is serious about internal ethics. He's hired federal prosecutors, former FBI agents. He's come up with a code of ethics. But for years, he and his supporters have resisted the kinds of democratic reforms that have been proposed by rank-and-file members, by Teamsters for a Democratic Union. And now, I suspect that changing the Constitution to call for direct elections, which are already part of the union's operating structure under the government consent decree, so it doesn't really change anything in the present. And if it's an attempt to get rid of the consent decree, as soon as the consent decree ends, they can call a special convention the day after and abolish direct elections. They can abolish their ethics code. They can abolish their whole internal ethics program. So I think that's the danger. And the question is, the government obviously should not be in the union forever. But when is the right time to end the supervision? And you see the scandal involving Billy Hogan, who incidentally was Hoffa's choice for the second in command, Secretary Treasurer, in 1996, but he had to withdraw because there were other charges against him. You look at that corruption scandal and several others that have taken place in the 3 or 4 years since Hoffa's been in power, and it doesn't look to me like it's time to end the consent decree now.
Tom Leadham, is it your sense in Las Vegas, as you're about to be nominated as one of the challengers for the presidency of the Teamsters, that the 4,000 delegates there want to see an end to the government oversight?
Well, everyone cheers when there's any discussion of government oversight. We have about 2,000 delegates and several thousand guests, retirees, and onlookers. The convention floor is certainly packed. I think there is tremendous support to get the government out of the union, which is the battle cry. But what Hoffa really means when he says get the government out of the union is get the IRB. They want to get the IRB out of the union, and they're really willing to make a deal with any anti-union politician from any party in order to get that done. That seems to be their number one legislative priority.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll come back with Tom Leadham, member of the Teamsters from Oregon, running for president of the Teamsters, one of the nation's largest unions, against James Hoffa this fall, and Carl Beers with the Association for Union Democracy. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the issue of the Teamsters, more than 4,000 delegates from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters meeting this week in Las Vegas to nominate candidates for the presidency of one of the nation's largest unions. It's the annual meeting of the Teamsters. By the way, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Tom Leadham, is that name ever going to change? How many women are in this union?
Well, we estimate that about 20% of the membership is are women, and we had made a proposal at the 1996 convention to change the name. It was voted down again by a majority of Hoffa delegates. That proposal has not come on the table at this point, at least at this convention.
What plank are you running on? Who is supporting you?
Well, we have the support of the progressive side of the union. By the way, we're doing quite well here. Many people would consider it sort of a guerrilla action, but we had our first vote count last night on actual candidates, which was our first indication of delegate strength. The Hoffa people had been claiming that we wouldn't have enough delegates to be nominated. We nominated all of our at-large candidates for vice president. The Teamster Executive Board is made up of 24, mostly vice presidents, a general president, a general secretary, treasurer, and then three trustees. We were able to nominate all of our at-large candidates, and actually we have picked up delegate support from our efforts on supporting the right thing on the floor of the convention in the face of tremendous odds. So we're quite pleased with the progress we're making here.
Your platform?
Our platform is contains many democracy issue positions and issues. In particular, we've proposed a membership bill of rights that gives members the right to participate in meetings and elections and other aspects of their union without fear of intimidation or discrimination or retaliation of any kind. We've also proposed that there be the right to information all members should be entitled to receive their local union contract. Many are not at the, are not able to get that at this time. We're also proposing that they receive the most recent LM2 and financial reports. LM2 is a Department of Labor filing that all unions have to do. We're also pushing for the election of stewards in the workplace so that people have the ability to elect those people that that closely represent them in the workplace. And there are a number of others. We're looking for the right to participate, have rank-and-file Teamsters participating in negotiations for their contract. We want the ability to approve officers' salaries. We want the right to vote on mergers or dissolution of local unions, and the right to participate in fair local union elections.
And how are you doing compared to when you ran against Hoffa several years ago?
Well, in 1998, we had a very short campaign, a five-month campaign. We were able to get 40% of the vote in a three-way race for our rank-and-file power slate. This is we're going head-to-head with Hoffa's machine in 2001, and we feel much better about it. We've been campaigning around the U.S. and Canada for several months now. Hoffa has a record now that he has to answer to. It's not a pretty picture. Teamster members understand that, and we are very encouraged, and we're especially encouraged with the reaction that we're getting here and at the convention from the rank-and-file Teamsters that are here.
What about the Teamsters' position on drilling in the Arctic and other environmental issues? I mean, you did have Hoffa's Teamsters in Seattle. You had the picture of James Hoffa with Ralph Nader.
Well, regarding the WTO, we were frustrated by the reports, especially in the progressive community, of Hoffa's involvement with WTO, because those of us on the inside who had been organizing for months and months to turn out large numbers of Teamsters in Seattle at the WTO, we were very successful in turning out large numbers of Teamsters. Mr. Hoffa jumped on the bandwagon about 1 month prior to the event. So we were frustrated by those reports. We're seeing with his current positions on these kinds of issues, we're just seeing his true colors, and this is nothing that we didn't anticipate. We fully expected it. It's gotten to the point where now they just pass out the propaganda from the oil companies. They don't even bother to print their own material. They just pass out the literature provided by the oil companies and rely on all their statistics and attempt to make it a jobs issue.
Carl Beer, can you put the Teamsters in the context of progressive union organizing around the country in relation to other unions?
I don't think progressive should be too hopeful about the Teamsters sort of getting in line with the progressive agenda based on Jimmy Hoffa's brief flirtation with Ralph Nader. I think it's pretty clear that he will support, as Mr. Leadham said, any politician who is willing to work on his main goal of ending the government consent decree. If Al Gore had won the election, I don't think you would be seeing Jimmy Hoffa calling for drilling in the Arctic. You would see him lining up behind Al Gore's positions. If Ralph Nader had won, you would have seen that too. So I don't think progressives really should expect too much from the Teamsters under Jimmy Hoffa, or from the Teamsters International, I should say. There are many, many progressive locals around the country. The local in Seattle, which was instrumental in organizing for the WTO protests, and several others around the country. I think if progressives are looking for alliances with labor, they ought to look at the locals for the time being and not the international.
And how, in terms of Teamster membership, the growth of Teamsters, does it compare to other unions?
Well, the Teamsters, the latest numbers, according to the reports to the Labor Department, have dropped. I think for the first time in 30 years, the Teamsters have less than 1.4 million members. They have not had the organizing success that took place under Ron Carey. Their big campaign, the most visible one, has been the overnight organizing campaign. And they put a lot of resources into it, and I don't think they're having the greatest success. You know, one of the great things that helped organizing for the Teamsters was the strike victory of the UPS workers. That had a tremendous effect, I think, on unorganized workers' opinion of the labor movement and of the Teamsters and the ability of unions to not just get new members but actually have some power in the workplace. And I think you need to see those kinds of victories in order to have organizing success. And I haven't seen anything that, I don't think Hoffa hasn't been in office that long, so, you know, the jury's still out on that, but we haven't seen that kind of enthusiasm, that kind of successful labor workplace action, which is necessary to organize.
And what about James Hoffa's relationship with John Sweeney and the AFL-CIO?
Well, the Teamsters are part of the AFL-CIO. They're still, I think, one of the largest, maybe the third largest in the union. And there's, John Sweeney does not have too much to say about internal union affairs, and they seem to have a fairly decent relationship. I don't know if there's much more to say about it.
Tom Leadham, as we wrap up, ballots will be sent out in the fall, early October, counted in November. Can you talk about the process from now until then? When will you be formally nominated?
Well, we'll be nominated. The nominations will be concluded on Thursday of this week. We'll be campaigning nonstop around the U.S. and in Canada. Our campaign is a real grassroots campaign. We'll be out there with Teamster members at plant gates. We have a great organization, and we feel we've got an excellent chance of winning this fall.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Tom Leadham, member of the Teamsters from Oregon, running for president of the Teamsters against James Hoffa Jr., and Carl Beers, Association for Union Democracy, based in New York, advising unions around the country. If people want to get more information, where can they go on the web?
They can go to our website, www.uniondemocracy.org. And just one quick correction. We counsel union members much more than we do unions themselves, union members on their rights in their unions, the rights to free speech, fair elections, and those sorts of things.
And Tom Leadham?
Well, they can log on and go to leadham.org. And that's our campaign website. And they can also get an update on the convention. We have steady updates on the convention throughout the week.
And that's Leadham, L-E-E-D-H-A-M.
.org.
I want to thank you both for being with us as we move on to another issue right now. An explosive report has just come out on NAFTA called Down on the Farm, NAFTA's 7 years war on farmers and ranchers in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. We're going to have a debate on it with one of the authors of the report, Lori Wallach, as well as a CNN commentator who was blasting it yesterday. We're going to go to that discussion right now. The issue of NAFTA continues to dog even the new administration, though it was pushed forward by the Clinton administration. Today, the report has come out on NAFTA in the run-up to the U.S. House of Representatives vote on NAFTA in 1993. Politicians, businesses, reporters alike sought to allay farmers' fears that the trade agreement would lead to plummeting prices and the loss of livelihoods. The Clinton administration claimed free trade would be the savior of American agriculture. But now, 7 years later, after NAFTA went into effect, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch has released this landmark in-depth investigation called Down on the Farm, which looks at NAFTA's effect on farmers and ranchers in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The report argues that contrary to the promises of politicians and the media, business leaders. Farm income has declined. Consumer prices have risen, and some giant agribusinesses have reaped huge profits. Small farmers in Mexico have had to leave their farms to work as farm laborers on large plantations where they work in squalid conditions for poverty wages. Today, we're going to have a debate on the issue. We're beginning with Lori Wallach. Lori Wallach, welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out the report that you just put out?
Well, we noticed a trend occurring across the country of many farmers and, for that matter, farm state members of Congress who had been big supporters of NAFTA and, for that matter, even had pushed for the China permanent normal trade relations, who more and more have been getting irate, have been complaining a lot that the promises that the trade proponents had offered had not come to stead, but worse, that under NAFTA particularly, their exports, which they had been promised would soar, had increased modestly in some instances, but that imports had flooded in so that the prices of the commodities, the prices the farmers were being paid, was dropping and dropping. And they were losing their farms. The rate of farm bankruptcies in the 7 years of NAFTA of small farms, farms under $100,000, were six times what they were before NAFTA. And so we started thinking, okay, well, farmers were supposed to do better under NAFTA. That was a big promise. They're losing. At least if they're getting paid less, us consumers should face lower prices for our food. So we started looking at the Consumer Price Index, and what we found was, even in the areas where there are floods and floods of NAFTA imports, Canadian wheat, so cereal and bread prices, vegetables from Mexico, consumer prices had gone up. In fact, they'd gone up almost 20% over the 7 years of NAFTA. So we started thinking, okay, who's winning? Maybe the Canadian and Mexican farmers are doing well. And what we found was, if anything, the farmers in Mexico and Canada, the small independent farms, were doing even worse than the U.S. guys. In Mexico, the government estimates millions and millions of small corn farmers have been forced off their land. And in Canada, the real irony is their exports did double. They got the export promise. Their farm income is down 40%. So we started systematically gathering all the data because what it looked to us was that this was actually proving that the NAFTA model, the export-led model, really, you know, it had been a cruel myth. And now President Bush wants fast track to expand the NAFTA, literally the NAFTA, to 31 more countries, including the Caribbean, Central America. And when we saw what it had done to small farmers in Mexico, what's happened to the rural communities in the U.S., and then all of us consumers are paying through the nose, we went to the SEC filings to see what the filings were of some big agribusinesses. And surprise, surprise, the same companies who had pushed for NAFTA are now having all of these pep rallies for fast track to get NAFTA expanded. They're doing really well, but us consumers and the farmers have really been clobbered. And I guess what our report does with 400 footnotes and an enormous amount of data is finally put the facts under the trend we saw of increased upset.
Jeff Rosenzweig also joins us, Associate Dean for Corporate Relations at Emory University, Professor of International Business and Finance there. We saw you throughout the day yesterday on CNN criticizing this report, saying you'd have to look pretty hard to find anyone who is unhappy with NAFTA right now. Can you talk about why, your reaction?
Your words are way too strong. First of all, I think Lori Wallach is the best person in her game. Obviously, she is someone who just doesn't like NAFTA and sure doesn't like a free trade area of the Americas. I wouldn't condemn the whole report. As Lori said, I think there's 407 footnotes. Well over 400. What I would have liked to have seen, though, is a more original economic analysis of the situation. As someone with a PhD in economics, you know, we do something we call general equilibrium. We look at the big picture. Don't you think that maybe what's affecting the farmers is the fact that there was an Asian crisis over these years, that Asia is many more people, many more potential consumers of our farm exports than even the people in the Americas? The population of Asia is almost 60% of world population, and they had a crisis, so they stopped buying. They also stopped sending tourists to Hawaii and California. It's nothing about the farmers. This is about a much bigger issue. Anyway, as I say, Laurie is the best at what she does. I don't want to condemn their report, but I do want to add some perspective here. First of all, and I'll look forward to Laurie coming back and edifying me on this, because obviously she studied this in much greater depth. I see on page 5 of their study, they say there's 33,000 farms disappearing. So, you know, emotionally, that's terrible. Wow, 33,000 farms. How about the probably 10 or 20 million jobs that have been created in service industries over this time period? Again, 33,000 farms. You know, if we want to play to people's emotions, that's great. But if we look at this in terms of the broader picture, see, even with my students as a professor, whenever I see 400-something footnotes, I wonder if footnotes are substituting for a deeper original analysis, the building of a model that looks at the whole world. Here I just see a lot of facts. Let me point out so I can give Laurie a chance to jump in.
Well, let me interrupt for one sec because stations have to break to identify themselves. But when we come back, we'll also be joined by a soybean and wheat farmer, president of the National Family Farm Coalition, Bill Christensen. We're talking about this new report out from Public Citizen called Down on the Farm, NAFTA 7 Years War on Farmers and Ranchers in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, with Laurie Wallach and Jeff Rosenzweig, who is at Emory University Business School and also a commentator on CNN. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. By the way, on Friday, we'll be joined by Amy Ray of the Indigo Girls here on Democracy Now! But now we are talking about the effect of NAFTA on the farm, on farmers, ranchers in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. A new report out by Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch. We're joined by one of its authors, Laurie Wallach, director of Global Trade Watch. Also on the phone with us, Jeff Rosenzweig, who is the Associate Dean for Corporate Relations at Emory University Business School, and author of the book Winning the Global Game, A Strategy for Linking People and Profits. Bill Christensen also joins us, president of the National Family Farm Coalition. He's based in Missouri. Well, what has been, from your perspective as a wheat and soybean farmer, the effect of NAFTA over the last 7 years, Bill Christensen?
Well, in addition to soybeans and wheat, we also raise corn and cattle. I'm out here on the farm while I'm the president of this national coalition. I'm also a practicing farmer on 2,000 acres in north central Missouri. And the report confirmed what we already knew, that farmers' prices are near record low levels. We have a situation here where trade and agriculture policy are very closely related, I think that we need to take a look at what's going on. You know, this country's policy should be more directed toward domestic policy instead of trade policy, because 80% of our production is consumed domestically and 20% goes for export. So, you know, we have a real financial problem in this country, and it continues. We lose about 500 farmers a week yet, and the outlook is not good.
Jeff Rosenzweig, as you hear that, the reason I had said that you'd harshly criticized on CNN is that basically the way they presented the Global Trade Watch report on CNN was saying this new report is out They didn't interview, at least the segments I saw, didn't interview the authors of the report, only you saying try to find one person who's not happy in the last 7 years, or you said something like that's what this report tried to do. What's your response to Bill Christensen?
I'd love you to send me a transcript of that. I don't remember saying that there's no one unhappy.
You said that they found the one person who wasn't.
Well, okay, now you've already admitted you completely twisted my words. What I'm saying is the farmers, and I have great sympathy for the actual practicing farmer that you just interviewed, the farmers are hurting. If you watch more of my commentary on CNN Headline News, I've been talking continually how anyone in an industry where we are good, and we're very good at farming, an export industry, is hurt by the very high value of the U.S. dollar. Now, as you know, the U.S. dollar is particularly high in Europe, and against the Japanese yen, it's rising. This is why I'm on there advocating that Greenspan cut interest rates and let's try to lower the dollar to help the U.S. farmer. Now, if you would not completely twist my words around when I'm on CNN, you would understand that all I was saying was this has nothing to do with NAFTA. The strength of the dollar, which makes it hard for our good farmers to export to Europe, which is a huge natural market for us. They don't have farmers as good as we do. They don't have as much land as we do in Europe to export to India and China. That has nothing to do with NAFTA. So my point is that it seemed like here's a report trying to attack NAFTA, which could be attacked. There's many people who don't like NAFTA, obviously, and there's many who do. But the fact that we've lost something like 33,000 farms over the last 7 years, that has nothing to do with NAFTA, or very little to do with NAFTA. Let me make my words careful. That has very little to do with NAFTA. I'd like Lori Wallach to tell me how many family farms we lost between the year 1900 and the year that NAFTA was instituted. These are longer-term technological trends. Maybe people hate technology. Maybe they hate technology replacing the family farm with bigger combines, technology replacing certain jobs with robotics. But we can't blame NAFTA for the advent of technology in certain industries.
Let's put that point to Lori Wallach.
Well, actually, you ought to read the report more closely, which anyone can see on our website, www.tradewatch.org. Because, in fact, we do the analysis comparing the loss of small farms during the 7 years of NAFTA as compared to the period before NAFTA.
4 years.
And it's a six-time increase.
Then, to deal with your question about the broader analysis,
we also, if you read it, did that. And, in fact, the most devastating issue regarding trade is, despite the Asian crisis, which did limit demand, the U.S. trade surplus in agriculture with the whole world declined 39% during the period of 7 years of NAFTA. But our trade surplus in agricultural products with the NAFTA countries declined 71%. So, in fact, we did do the broad analysis of the other factors, including the currency, including the Asia demand dropping. And remarkably, despite what was preferential terms sold as part of NAFTA, our trade balance with the NAFTA countries has dropped more than two times faster. We have more than two times more imports from those countries and less exports than with the whole world. So actually, the fact that you raise about the Asia crisis makes that even more stark, given during that period you had demand dropping and the NAFTA trade balance was two times worse than the world trade balance. Moreover, if you look at overall
do we have a trade surplus?
31% or 33,000 farms disappearing. And then you compare that to 10 or 20 million jobs created in the service sector. It's apples and oranges. If you want to talk about jobs, then you need to look at the manufacturing job loss under NAFTA, which is up around a million, and compare that with the Department of Labor data about those jobs, union jobs with benefits paying on average $15 to $18 an hour, compared to the part-time, no-benefits, minimum-wage service sector jobs. You know as well as I do that if you look at the jobs, not the farm sector, job creation top five categories by the U.S. Department of Labor is retail clerk, janitor, prison guard, etc. These are not good-paying jobs. So if you want to talk about NAFTA ruining jobs, different issue, different study. What I'm talking about is the promise for consumers to have cheaper food and for U.S., Mexican, and Canadian farmers to have more income. And 7 years of NAFTA, those farmers have seen their income tank, and us consumers have seen our food prices rise.
Jeff Rosenzweig.
again, we're taking these isolated incidents. We keep hearing about the consumer price rising, and that's why I was so interested to do read this report, including the tiresome 400-something footnotes. You have said repeatedly on this show, as well as in the report, that consumer prices have risen less than 20% cumulative in 7 years. Now, I hate to say this as a professor, but you know the cost of going to universities has risen much more cumulatively over 7 years than 20%. The cost of going to the hospital has probably risen five times that. The cost of getting your car fixed. This is probably the slowest increase for the consumer in food prices in many decades.
As you know,
that's about
2%
a year annualized.
Remember, the consumer price index is controlled for inflation. So those are real prices.
It is not.
Those
it's a measure
costs.
Of inflation. Lori, this is my problem with you. I think you're a good author. You put in a lot of footnotes. You're a good debater. But what do you mean it's controlled for inflation?
It's in real dollars.
It's not in real dollars. You're talking about the consumer price index. That's how we go back and we look at inflation. And this says nothing about real. I have your report in my hands. You told everyone to go to your website. Let's go to your website. Where does it say in real terms?
The consumer price index, you're saying that the consumer price index only measures the inflation of the currency and not the real cost of the food?
Oh, Lori, that's what it measures, is how fast the food price went up. And you said, yes, it went up 20% in 7 years. And I said, that is probably the slowest rate of inflation we've had in many decades in food prices, and it's also a lot slower than how fast the consumer price index went up for healthcare services, for educational services, for transportation services. It shows, and I agree with the farmer, the farmers are hurting. I'm as worried about that as you are. I'm just not sure why you say that.
You were one of the guys who told us we were going to have consumer
price cuts.
That's the whole myth of free trade.
No, I was
right?
never going to say that.
We're supposed to wait for the price cuts, more free trade, cheaper products.
I want to bring Bill Christensen back into the conversation,
sure,
president of the National Family Farm Coalition. Go ahead, Bill Christensen.
The point I would like to make is that according to USDA, that in the years between 1975 and 1979, the U.S. overall export on corn was 1.9 billion bushel. Now, down through the years, after all the WTOs, the GATS, the NAFTAs, and now the free trade of the Americas, in the years between 1996 and 2000, guess what the overall total corn export is? It's still 1.9 billion bushel. Domestic production and use has increased considerably, about 2 billion bushel. But here's the trouble out here on the farm. From 1975, the gross adjusted income per acre of corn production went from $562 to the years between 96 and 2000, an average of $347, far below our cost of production.
No. That's the perfect answer, sir, because that is just my point, that the farmer is hurting, may need to look at domestic policy, but this is a longer-term trend. As you're saying, the farmer was much better off in the 1970s, and there was a great decline in the late 1970s into the 1980s. The farmer the family farm has been in decline since the 19th century, and that was exactly my point on CNN for our moderator, is that if you want to look for a group that's hurting, I agree, the family farmer is hurting. But then all of a sudden to come around and say, here's people that's hurting, let's try to get them into a anti-NAFTA parade. The farmer is hurting for factors that have nothing to do with NAFTA. It has to do with a longer-term decline in family farms and family farm income. And again, if Lori compared that for 4 years, for instance, before NAFTA to after NAFTA, let's go back 100 years. How many family farms have been lost since 1900? And then Lori's 33,000 that have been lost since NAFTA began, what percent is that of the total family farms lost since 1900? Then we'll see that the family farmer has been hurting for at least a century, and that may be a matter of domestic policy, but that NAFTA is a very small, if any, part of that overall decline, painful decline in the family farm.
Well, you know, I believe there's other factors here. You know, I think that part of the problem is that producers and consumers are not at the trade negotiating tables. I know that multinational corporations are dictating to government officials, and, you know, this is because of other failures like campaign restructure laws there.
Exactly.
The issue of agribusiness is not one that I heard discussed very much on CNN, and that it, the what you're laying out, Lori Wallach, in your report down on the farm is not small farmers of Missouri versus the small farmers of Mexico who are making a killing, but that both of those are getting hammered by the consolidation of agribusiness.
Well, that's the case, but I'm still sort of speechless at the notion that NAFTA, that Jeff would make the argument that NAFTA has nothing to do with this, though I guess that's part of the corporate communications game. The things about NAFTA and as well globally the WTO that made all the difference is for the first time, and the reason why the loss of farms is escalating since and as a result of these policies is that for the first time under those two agreements, the U.S. is required, mandated, that it accept imports, even in areas where U.S. farmers are fully able to produce sufficient quantities of a particular commodity or food to feed the U.S. population.
This is amazing,
Laurie. And the result
you've
got supply flooding in so that you depress the overall commodity price. And so, for instance, the U.S. is an exporter of wheat, except under NAFTA, we've been required to accept tons and tons and tons of Canadian wheat. The huge flood of supply has resulted in the prices for the producers declining, which I agree is a trend that's gone on but has been exacerbated as compared to remedied by these trade agreements. Now, if already these farmers are suffering, then you translate that into prices have gone down, and this gets back to the consolidation of agribusiness. Prices have gone down for those farmers. Okay, so where is that money going? Is it getting passed on in consumer price cuts, the promised reduction in prices? I personally would not like to see the small farmers clobbered, but if you look at it simply from the perspective of a poor consumer who's not in a rural area and you say, okay, the farmers got clobbered, but at least our price of food is down. But in fact, the price of food did not decline. The farmers did get clobbered.
Laurie,
and
has
what
your
I
salary
report
declined?
Finds
has your salary declined over the last 7 years?
Is
nothing
record
declined.
Profits for a handful of the big commodity groups. And what NAFTA does practically, and there's three different chapters that sort of combine to do this, is facilitate the big commodity companies setting up what are called export platforms. They can effectively
real fast, we only have a minute.
Work the price of the commodity in the market by dumping into the market more supply than is needed.
Jeff Rosenzweig, this issue of large agribusiness being the big winner here over the small farmers of whatever country.
I did read those reports carefully. I learned from their work as I do from all, careful studies. I still say that's probably been going on for what? At least 100 years. Also, it's not just agribusiness if the consumer pays more. There's many people, again, in service jobs, retailers, processors, et cetera. These are much bigger trends. Again, I feel for the family farmer because there's so few in the U.S., and if we lost 33,000, it hurts. But as Laurie has said repeatedly, we have a trade surplus, even if it has diminished a little bit. We have a trade surplus in agriculture with the NAFTA country. If we had not signed NAFTA, if we all closed the borders, our farmers would have lost many more jobs. We export more agricultural product than we import. Then we create jobs for family farmers, income for family farmers. Laurie wants to repeal the laws of comparative advantage. She says, well, if we can
we're
do
out
something
of time.
For ourselves, if we didn't have trade, we would have less farmers because we do, at the end of the day, export more farm product.
Laurie Wallach, if people want to get hold of Down on the Farm, NAFTA 7 years war on farmers and ranchers in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, where can they go on the web?
The website, www.tradewatch.org.
Bill Christensen, President, National Family Farm Coalition, where can they reach you?
www.nffc.net.
And Jeff Rosenzweig, Associate Dean for Corporate Relations at Emory University, author of Winning the Global Game, A Strategy for Linking People and Profits. Thanks for being with us. Mail at Democracy Now! Is our email address. That's mail at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.